Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 1:34, Wednesday, February 24th, 2010. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas, and Senator Egan. We've got Senator Pascal with us, and we'll have all the other legislators come and go as the afternoon wears on. We're going to run a little late on the calendar today. We're going to finish up our presentation this afternoon on the gas tax review with the Department of Revenue. We'll take a brief at ease in, and we'll set up for the next presenter. And we'll continue on with Mr. Dan Dickinson, our legislative consultant, along with Dr. David Wood, who's come over from London to help us. We were scheduled to go, I think, to 3 o'clock, but we're probably going to be running later than that. Because what I'd like to do is get our two upcoming presentations done today to stay on schedule. And Senator Hoffman,
with that, we have that will run into some oversights of two committees. I think we had the governor's office and the legislature. Those will be put back by 1 hour, from 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock, and I think 4:15. So, just for everybody's information.
Okay. And I just want to stay on tracks, and then we'll have presentations tomorrow dealing with some global issues. With that, Commissioner Galvin, if you could put your name on record and pick up where we left off, or maybe even review a little bit of that formula again in regs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Galvin, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. So going back a couple slides, so we ended with a discussion of the methodology that's proposed in the draft regulations for determining the gas production tax under the current tax system for the purposes of establishing the AGIA tax inducement. And again, what we have is, while there's different numbers reflected in the oil tax revenue, gas tax revenue, and then combined, we look at the percentage of the production tax, or the point of production value that is attributable to gas, and use that same percentage against the combined tax obligation to get to the gas production tax that is considered to be in place at the commencement of the initial open season. And then that number is what would be compared to the tax that's in place at the time that they're actually producing. And just so that folks at home aren't confused, and we make it clear, the regulations merely put in place the way in which you would calculate this figure. That these numbers are for illustration purposes only. They do not establish anything with regard to what an actual exemption may be, but is just a way of showing how the calculation would be done. And it's literally going to be different for every taxpayer depending upon their percentage values between oil and gas and what their own individual combined tax obligation would be.
If we've had a question asked on the production tax value on the barrel of oil basis, which is the 88.45 number, and then 1933, then there's the $47 average. How could you help us real quick how you got to 47?
The 47 is, you take the production tax value that you see in the combined manner here, and then you have to take the combined taxable volume, and it's not actually shown up here, but it is the conversion. I can tell you what the math is. If you take the price times the annual production, and you then take out the royalty value, then you get a taxable volume. You do the same for the gas, having to convert the volume here, the 1643, into the barrel of oil equivalent. And I don't have the slide in front of me, but I don't know if Rich, if you want to, well, we can get you we'll get you the formula.
Okay, that's fine.
That'll explain. And that gets you the volume of gas on a barrel of oil equivalent. You combine the two of those to get your total taxable volume on a barrel of oil equivalent basis, and then divide that into this production tax value, and that's what gets you the price.
You can either send us the Excel sheet or whatever, however you want to do that.
Sure.
We'll clear that up. Confusion.
If you want to do it, never mind. I don't want to complicate it. So, and the last thing, just because I don't want anybody to confused by this slide. This $300 million down here is basically meaningless in the sense of an actual value. The only value of this slide is to demonstrate the fact that you first have to, in order to understand what your tax exemption, and that just means how you, the mechanics of allowing the taxpayer to get the benefit of the inducement, which is ostensibly to say your gas production tax isn't going to be higher at the time you produce than it is under the system that's in place at the commencement of the initial open season. In order to make that effective, it's in the form of an exemption for the difference. To get that difference, you have to first calculate what your gas production tax would be under the system of the day, whatever it may be. And I'm just pulling completely out of the air this 1.5, because it's going to be based upon something that the legislature does something, whatever you do is going to potentially result in a higher production tax at that time. If it does result in a production tax of 1.5, they would then compare it to this number that was derived in this method to then end up with an exemption of the $300 million.
If we can hold it there for a minute, Senator Hoffman.
But doesn't that, since that locks in the tax at May 1, doesn't that take away our ability to raise the tax? Because what you're going to do is end up subtracting that amount, and what we will have is basically in before us under this scenario, a level of tax, gas tax exemption will be. That's what will be before us. So why have a raise in production taxes? Because what we'll be netting out is the ability to for the legislature not to change the gas production tax, but just set what rate, if it's going to be higher, what the gas tax exemption will be. That's the only thing before the legislature then.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair. two issues there. One, the first one is that under this demonstration, the big assumption is that all of the gas that is represented in this slide is being transported on capacity that was acquired during this initial open season. It is likely that there will be some capacity acquired during this initial open season, and there'll be other capacity that will be acquired subsequent. At that point, if there's a change in the production tax on gas, then the exemption would only be available to those who acquired their capacity at this initial open season. The second thing is that you are correct in that if all of the gas is shipped on capacity acquired during the initial open season, the effect of the exemption means that the legislature could not raise the gas production tax effectively above the figure that is calculated in this method. What I'm presenting to you here is for you as a legislature to determine if that is an acceptable place for the state to be going into this initial open season. Given that you can see here, and I'm sure over the coming days and weeks, we'll have multiple runs of this methodology, you will have to make a determination of whether this calculation method results in the gas production tax that is locked in being too low, in which case then something would have to be done before May 1st to change that.
Senator Hoffman?
Well, I think that the legislature may want to look at options where we are not locked in on the gas production tax. You know, I think that that is something that if we take action before May 1, what are our options between now and then, besides having the gas production tax locked in?
I'm not prepared to answer that. I think it's a legal question as to whether or not a change in the statute that would change the upstream inducement would implicate the license, but I'd have to check with Department of Law on that. I don't have a legal opinion.
And I think we're going to kind of sort that out as we go forward, how much flexibility the legislature actually has after May 1. Clearly, I think we can do what we want to before May 1 without rocking the boat.
Mr. Chair, I think clearly you have the authority to do whatever you want with regard to the production tax. I think the question that was raised was whether you can change the nature of the inducement or eliminate the inducement between now and May 1, and I don't have a legal opinion established on that that hasn't been asked before.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Somewhat related to that, as far as inducement, as I look at the charts, I keep coming back to the 12 to 1 and the 15 to 1 ratio and the $100 versus $8 gas and $120 versus $8 gas and $1 billion in the first scenario at $100 and $8 gas and $120 and $8 gas. And is the inducement you're considering there in that point that the reduction in production taxes is money that stays with the industry? Is that the outfall of those two scenarios anyhow?
In
you obviously
manner,
reduced it by $1 billion in one case and $2 billion in the other. So
in a manner of speaking, yes.
So if we look at that, the credits applied remain the same. Would it not in some make better sense at this point in time, when this is a scenario that's years again into the future, that if we separated them two at this point in time, we could offer credits, which is what has been indicated to me by the oil industry that they'd like to see, credits in the form of infield drilling or even some shaving of the progressivity, and make both parties happy by adding, not proposing this at that point in time, but just suggesting that this is a way of not going as far as $1 billion, because you could even give 50% more credits and you'd be only going from 440 million to 660 million, and that would be a $200 million increase, saving you in the case of the billion, $800 million, and in the other case, $1.8 billion.
Senator Thomas, through the chair.
Or retaining, I guess I should say.
You are taking a slide that is a snapshot of a particular price comparison, of particular assumptions, and trying to create a recommendation for a tax system that would have to apply to a broad range of potential scenarios. What I would suggest is that you would want to look at what the states take, as it were, and the producers take would be under your proposal under a variety of scenarios. And what it sounded to me, just based upon what you were throwing out there, is that although it may be that the state may have a better return given this spread or parity situation, if you took your same example and looked at it, if prices were 8-1 or 10-1, the state would have significantly less revenue than under the current system. And you would need to make a value judgment as to whether you're going to give up the additional revenue that you would get under what has been historically normal relationship in exchange for getting more revenue at times that are in the less frequent price relationship.
I understand it's a snapshot in time, but anyhow, just a question.
And if we could, before we, I think, move on to the next section, we've spent a lot of time on the gas production tax exemption issue and the royalty inducement. Can you just refresh our memory on that real quick and the impact that would have on our cash flow?
The royalty inducement is twofold. One, it provides a methodology for establishing the value, the market value of the gas for royalty calculation purposes, using a methodology that would be more, I wouldn't say predictable, it would be more easily calculated by the producer than the current method, which is basically what your sales are, and then you have to provide your transactions, and there's a opportunity to look back over the contracts, reopen it, and so forth. Under the inducement for value, it would be a calculation based upon published prices in the market, for example, with AECO. And so the change in, for example, this line item here in terms of the royalty value is basically going to be a product of how closely the published prices are to the actual sales contracts. And given that AECO is a liquid, large, generally efficient market, you would expect there to be very little deviation between that value under either methodology, but the benefit to the taxpayer is more predictability in the sense of what they owe and not having to have it recalculated 2 to 3 years later. And so that's, I don't think it should change that number. It just changes the relationship between the state and the producer to make that calculation method a little more straightforward. The second royalty inducement has to do with the state's ability to switch between in-kind and in-value. And that, if the state is to take, and this is all, just by the way, this is all Department of Natural Resources responsible for this, I'm talking in an informative manner, not with the authority to actually be establishing any of this, just because I know what they're working on. The value issue, if it were to be taken in kind, is obligated to meet the in value value that you would get if you were just taking it in cash. And so at the end of the day, the number should be relatively similar as well. But the value, the benefit of the inducement has to do with the certainty on the part of the producer as to whether or not the state is going to take their gas in kind or in value. Under the current leases, we're able to switch with as little as a few months' notice, given the long capacity positions that you need to take in order to anticipate being able to ship gas, having up to 12.5% or more switching into your control or out of your control puts you at a significant commercial disadvantage. And so the inducement is intended to provide more certainty for the producer as to whether the state's going to have it in kind or in value, and provide some protection if the state is to switch, what the state would do in order to protect this producer's interests in those commercial arrangements.
So under this example up here, the 6.4 and the 1.1 and the ending up with 5.5, if we under this scenario, then if we were to take our royalties, which is 12.5%,
right, 12.5% listed
in kind, how does this apply into the affect this 5.5 billion?
It wouldn't affect it at all. Let me just make sure to clarify. Royalty in kind means taking our contractual right to a royalty in the form of gas. The only way that an in-kind take on the part of the state is going to affect the bottom line on this chart is if the state chose to take its tax in kind. That's a whole different situation, but that was what was proposed in the stranded gas contract, was for the state to take its tax share in kind under contract and not have the option of taking it in value. It then depends upon how you calculate what that share is. If you use this production tax methodology for determining what the state share is, it would create a complication to right. try to establish what the how much volume of gas would be equivalent to the state's gas production tax value to take it in kind.
So maybe what we'll do is we'll get back to the committee on that, because I am curious, when you have a $2 billion swing in the cash flow, how does that affect that if we were to take it in kind to deal with in-state gas issues or whatever we decide to do with it, just as an exercise. So I want to be comfortable with how that mechanism works under this scenario of high oil and low gas.
Mr. Chair, if you're looking at taking the tax value in kind, I think you're talking about maybe you're going to need to specify more than just what would happen if you took your tax value in kind, because we could come up with a method. I mean, we could just, in this example, using the point of production value or some other value, designate a volume of gas that would be the equivalent in value of this $1.199 billion, and that would be your volume of gas that would you would take in kind as a payment of this tax obligation.
I think we'll just go on, because okay. I think the issue there is, again, with the $2 billion offset. So we'll work on that a little later. I want to keep things moving so everybody doesn't fall asleep this afternoon after lunch.
Might be too late for that already. The next section I just wanted to touch upon goes to something that we've spent time here kind of reflecting on, which is what are the price expectations for oil and gas 10 years from now, and what's our level of confidence in what they may turn out to be. So as far as parity is concerned, this chart represents the past experience with regard to the oil gas parity relationship, and you can take your own conclusions from it. There's a period of time, about 14 years, in which the price generally stayed in the vicinity of 8-1, venturing up to sometimes 12-1, down to 5-1, sometimes down to 4-1, and stayed in that range, generally below a 10-1 relationship. In the most recent past, it's obviously been much higher than that. And the question then you have to ask yourself is, okay, what happens to the right of this chart? Are we going to have a situation similar to what you see in the 90s, where we had a period of dislocation that was followed by the long period of a parity level that I just described? Or are we at some new relationship that is going to establish long term?
I'd like just the record to reflect Senator Stevens has joined us.
So we look at the experience of those who have tried to forecast oil and gas prices, and what you generally see, and this is frankly similar to what I see when I look back at the Department of Revenue's experience at forecasting oil prices, is this is a chart that the EIA, the Energy Information Administration, federal government's forecasting arm for energy prices, put out in 2008 to kind of show their own track record for forward-looking projections on oil prices. And what you see is that at various junctures, when they look forward, they generally see prices starting at the point where they're at and kind of going up from there. And you see this kind of pattern develop where they expect the prices to start where they're at now and then move forward. And prices obviously have fallen a much different path than what they had projected at that time. In 2008, for example, when they put this chart out, they were in this upward swing of the market, and they were saying, well, the price should be coming back down to equilibrium in the $50 range and then kind of slowly rise from there. Then what happened next? We all saw the experience of prices spiking, and these are on, I think, monthly or annual price points. Prices spiked and then dropped precipitously, and now we've got the EIA saying the prices are going to climb from this level up into over $100 in that period of time. What actually is going to happen from this point forward, I can tell you is probably not going to be what they say, because it'll be something different. Whether we end up in that range by 2020 is a question. Similarly, when you look at the gas experience, what is the gas situation going to look like 10 years from now? And you look back just over the last 5 years, what have the expectations done over the last 5 years? These are the, you know, industry experts, the industry direction that they're expecting things to go, the best thoughts at that particular day. You go back and you have a period from 2005 to 2008 where everybody was talking about the shortfalls of gas, that we weren't going to have any gas, and we were going to be looking at having to import huge amounts of LNG in order to be able to meet the national need for natural gas. Then you turn a corner in 2009 where suddenly shale and other unconventional gases exceed predictions, and everybody's saying, and then at the same time you have an economic slowdown, and the world looking forward looks an awful lot like the world of the day, and that is a world of excess gas and low prices. And the question becomes, when we are looking at 2020 to 2030, what is the relationship going to be at that time, given the amount of uncertainty that we've even seen in just the last few years? And so just the takeaway from our purposes is we need an approach that adapts to a number of possible future states. So just closing out and capturing kind of from a legislative position, you know, what are the gas tax policy options to look at as we move towards the sanctioning time for this gas pipeline? And I mentioned earlier in the presentation the issues that are going to be flowing through this building for the next, I would expect, couple of years are going to be issues associated with what's the state's appropriate cash flow from a pipeline, what are the risks that the state's willing to bear with regard to price and other factors, and what's the level of certainty the state is going to provide with regard to our fiscal system. And just looking at the fiscal system that we would consider moving forward with, it is a policy consideration in weighing these various factors, the risks of price changes and the effects on the state system. You can leave the current system as is and accept that gas price risk is an incentive for the producers to participate in this project. You can decide you just want to eliminate the risk that the combined oil and gas tax revenue would be less than the oil tax. That's a floor, as it were, with the oil tax, and say that that's our minimum, that when we calculate your tax separately with just your oil portion, that that's going to establish the minimum tax that you'll pay under our system, so that you don't end up with a negative. Or if you want to reduce the effect of the parity issue on the slide in the oil tax revenue, you can establish a collar of some sort around the parity ratio and say if it exceeds a particular price ratio, that we're going to use a different methodology for determining the barrel of oil equivalent. Or separate or ring fence gas production under a wholly separate tax system and develop a way in which you allocate the cost between the two, if you're going to keep it as a net system or move to a gross system, and recognize that the changes in the cash flow derived from the new system are going to affect the economic picture of the gas line project and incorporate that into the decision-making and the policy decisions with regard to the tax system on gas. So that's just trying to frame up what we see as at least one suite of considerations going forward.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are those options available regardless of open season, regardless of what happens on May 1st, in your opinion?
Yes, they are all available regardless of what happens, to the extent that the gas production tax for the gas that is shipped on capacity that gets the inducement would be basically capped, as it were, based upon the methodology that we ran through earlier.
And that, I guess, is the question that I have, is that if we have this lock-in, how does that lock-in coincide with our Constitution, where we can't bind future legislators from setting tax policy? I think that was the main question when we were talking about gas when Governor Murkowski was here. You know, our ability to do that, many legislators felt that we did not have that authority. And given that, how do we reconcile that with the Constitution?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I think the legislative record is fairly clear, and this might actually answer the question that I wasn't able to answer earlier, that given that a current legislature can't bind a future legislature, and that the AGIA tax inducement was crafted with that in mind, it was set as a statement of good faith, but there would be no remedy to a taxpayer if the legislature adopted a tax change and said that the exemption would no longer apply.
But prior to my question, you had stated that except for the provisions of the formula that was set in AGIA, we can manipulate the gas tax structure. And now you're saying we can manipulate that tax structure. So which one is it?
Senator Hoffman, my answer the first time was assuming that the legislature would want to honor the exemption that was put into the AGIA statute. Each legislature moving forward has the authority to decide to remove that.
And is there any recourse against that can be brought back from the industry side of the table?
I do not believe so, given the discussion during the AGIA legislative process. I think it was fairly clear that the legislature, in establishing that inducement, chose to reject the contractual relationship that would bind the parties and create a remedy, and instead created one that would be subject to the continual good faith of the legislature to decide whether or not to keep it in place.
So just to try to clarify that point, and the May 1st deadline has no validity come next January 20th, when we're back in session and we decide to scrap the whole thing and rewrite it, as a hypothetical, as far as the gas tax.
Senator Stedman, it has as much validity as the legislature chooses to give it.
Okay. Any other questions for the commissioner? Okay, we are going to take a brief at ease and set up for the next presenter. We're at ease. Back to resemblance of order here today. This afternoon, next up, we're going to have Mr. Dan Dickinson, who is a consultant for legislative budget and audit, which is a committee. You're not committing. I can't even think right now. I have too much oil and gas stuff, but works for the hired consultant working for the legislature to help us deal with issues relating to our tax agenda or our tax status. So he's prepared a presentation on production tax, and then following him will be Dr. David Wood, who has also been working on this issue for the legislature. With that, Mr. Dickinson, if you could put yourself on the record and who you represent and take us through your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Dickinson. I'm a self-employed CPA in private practice. I am doing some work for LBNA on a number of issues, and this is one issue that they've asked me to spend some time working on. What I've done today at the chairman's request is put together a presentation focused on one particular issue in the relationship between oil and gas, and I'd like to walk through that. A lot of what I'm going to say is going to line up very closely with what you've heard from the commissioner this morning. It's going to be different in some places, and we'll walk through the differences in the places where it's the same. The first question I think is probably on everyone's mind is, why are we going through all these numbers? Why is everyone trying to figure all this stuff out? And I think it's very important to my mind, and the reason that it's being wrestled with and the reason you need to look at it is, you have to figure out whether the tax system is stable, it's robust, it's going to be viable over a wide range of conditions. I think one of the things that's happened in the last year is we've suddenly seen a condition that we all sort of took for granted, that oil and gas would sell roughly at the equivalent, at kind of some kind of energy parity, the amount of energy you could release when you burn that fuel. We've seen that essentially, what we found out in the real world is, no, that's not going to be the case. There are other things that override that. So what I think the legislature really wants to make sure is that they've created a tax system which is going to be viable over a wide range of options, including one that's going to make a gas project more viable. So that's the first question. What you know, we need to see, is it going to be stable? Is it going to be robust? Part of what's going on within that system is that there's cross subsidies. There's ways that oil taxes and gas taxes interact, if you think of them separately, or you can look at the whole system and say, gee, there aren't really any gas taxes and oil taxes. They're simply a tax on the hydrocarbons that are produced with some rules. But I think economists and accountants, you love to sit down and figure it out and look at these cross subsidies. And one of the things I think's happened here is when we've raised this issue and pointed out, gee, in a situation like this, for example, you have oil, you're producing oil. There's a price spike like we had in 2009, and suddenly the gas line comes on stream and production taxes start to fall. Well, what's happening in that case is you really have sort of a cross subsidy. One taxation on one of the hydrocarbons is supporting taxation on the other, is paying the difference. And I think it's very important that as folks look at that and they say, gee, when that occurs, when gas brings down oil taxes, see, that's an incentive, so it's good. It'll help encourage the gas line. And then you look at a different set of prices and the opposite happens. Gas comes on and there's an increase in tax. Well, yeah, we're getting the gas and that's good. We should have this increase in tax. So the notion is, rather than having something that's very sensitive, not to the critical production parameters, but to sort of this interaction between oil and gas prices in the market, you can make clear what the subsidies are. Are subsidies appropriate? When gas prices are very low, is the gas line getting some kind of tax support? When oil prices or gas prices are very high, is it going away? So I think there's ways that can all be much clearer. I think the current system, it tends sometimes to produce results that isn't always clear. The final piece is really focusing on this notion of how would the state react if you had a large drop in revenue. I think I've those of you who have seen a presentation that I gave on this roughly a year ago, you know, sort of I conjured up this notion of we'd be collecting our oil tax, the gas line that all of us have you know, dreamed about for decades comes online, and the state's revenues fall. They don't rise. Because as the chairman has pointed out, probably most people politically would find that unacceptable. And so how would the state react in a system like this? How stable would a tax system that has those kind of cross-subsidies in it, how stable would it be? How would the state react? To whom would it look for the revenue? And that, I think, gets into the fiscal stability issue that the commissioner just finished talking about, and I'll have some comments on that later as well. There are two, actually, there's many, many ways of measuring the issue. Among them are two, and I think you've seen some of this from the commissioner already, and I will use the same two measures. But one is you look at the gas, and when you add gas, when a producer increases the amount of gas that it's producing and selling, how much does it drag down or compensate for the taxes it's paying on oil? In other words, what you will find is, except in sort of very bizarre circumstances, which can occur, oil taxes will always be higher if the producer has no gas, and they'll be lower if the producer has gas. And so the combined oil and gas production tax is under the current system, is always going to give a lower result, a lower tax, than if it were oil alone. You know, people who want to phrase it poorly would say, gee, it's dragging down progressivity. Folks who say, gee, that's an incentive, talk about compensating. But I think that the mathematical outlines of it aren't really in doubt. A second way of measuring this is to say, in some cases, the amount that gas actually drags down the total tax paid by the hydrocarbons is so large that revenues actually fall. In some cases, you'd say, gee, the taxes, well, there's less production tax than there would have been. We're going along, we're paying in under the current system. The gas, a gas project comes on, and the production tax revenues fall. And you can create scenarios. I think actually the commissioner had one up here where the fall in revenues is so great that, for example, it eats up all the royalties that the state would be getting. So essentially, the state is both giving away the gas and then sort of also accepting a tax reduction from other folks to take the gas they've been given. So, you know, that doesn't happen under all numbers. I'm not saying it does, but you can certainly create scenarios with numbers that we have seen that yield that result. So I hope I've explained why we're walking through this.
Mr. Dixon, if you could just define what you mean by numbers we have seen.
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, what I'm really talking about, and there have been some slides so far, and I'll get into some that are more specific, and then Dr. Wood has some. What I'm really talking about is oil values and gas values that we have actually seen in the marketplace in the lower 48, and then the kinds of costs that it will take to get there. For example, in the gas issue, that's sort of the forefront and center now, is in an open season, what kind of costs can be put forward to get the gas to the market, and who will bear the risk of the various elements of that. But the two main things I'm talking about, Mr. Chairman, are how much does oil sell for the market, something that, you know, since I've been involved with this issue has ranged between $9 back in 1999 when the first month I became director of the tax division, sort of a welcome on board, and to a height of something approaching $140 a month, $140 a barrel. Gas prices, during the period, for example, of the hurricanes in the Gulf, Katrina, got up to the $12 range. As recently as 4 months ago, this fall, they actually broke through the $2 barrier. I think it was $1.88. That was a daily price. It didn't sustain for a month, but that's still a very wide range and one that we've seen very recently. So, Mr. Chairman, it's those range of prices that I'm talking about. This is a presentation, or this slide is from a presentation that I gave to the LBNA a little bit over a year ago. And again, I'm going to drag you through the calculations here, but I think it's very important for folks to understand how the combined oil and gas tax works, the fact that it is a combined tax. So let's, for a minute, when I set this up before, it was a series of slides. I've tried to put this all in one slide so people maybe can see all the comparison pieces, but I'm going to walk down this first column that says oil only. So let's assume for a minute that were kind of in the status quo. And when I say that, and this is something that the commissioner mentioned briefly, there is some gas sales. There are some gas sales going on, but they're a very small proportion of what's going on. It's gas to get various projects going. There are some sales from the Cook Inlet. But fundamentally, we're looking at a gas. What the state of Alaska does now is export gas. Excuse me, export oil. So we're looking at this oil-only scenario, and I chose a nice round number here. You'll see why in a moment, of 700,000 barrels a day. I think we're a little bit under that now. That actually might have been more appropriate back in 2008. 365 days a year means we're roughly producing 255 million barrels a year. And a barrel under the energy equivalent system is a barrel. So that's 255 barrel BOEs, or barrel equivalents. The data I used here, simply the day I was pulling together the presentation, was January 26, 2008. I'm guessing that's a typo because I wouldn't have been presenting 10 months later, but I could look that up, Mr. Chairman. But this was a daily price, very close to when I was putting this presentation together, of roughly $80 a barrel. If you look at the revenue sources book published by the Department of Revenue, they said it cost about $6.34 to get that barrel from the North Slope, or from a field on the North Slope, a Kuparuk or something, all the way down through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, through tankering, down to the west coast of the U.S., where the markets where most of the oil is sold. So that brings you down, when you subtract the 634 from the 792, it brings you down to the gross value at the point of production. I think that was, again, a term mentioned by the commissioner this morning. It's a term of art. It's very important in our tax structure. And at that point, you can simply multiply that 7338 times the 255 million barrels, and you say the gross value of the oil produced was $18.7 billion. 12.5% of that is royalty. It's roughly 12.5%. It's slightly higher, but we can use that for most leases are 12.5%, and so that is not taxable under our system, and so what remains when you subtract that 12.5% is $16.4 billion. Another number that came from the Department of Revenue was, what are the costs on the lease? In other words, upstream of the point of production, what are the costs that it takes to get the oil out of the ground, get it to the lease boundary? And roughly $4 billion was spent on that project. So what you come down to when you subtract the upstream costs and the downstream costs and the royalty is the taxable value, or what's the acronym, PTV, or production tax value, of $12 billion. Okay, how is that taxed? Under the current system, you look at the taxable volumes, which again are just going to be 87.5%, in other words, the non-royalty of this 255. So that's 223 barrels. You simply say, what's the dollar per barrel that you come out to? And it's $53.98. The first $30 per barrel do not trigger progressivity. In other words, if the value of a barrel of oil is after you've subtracted all the costs, is less than $30, no progressivity is going to be triggered, and the tax calculation is simply 25% times the value. However, in this case, we're above 30, so we're at $53.98. You subtract 30 from it, and the amount driving your progressivity factor is $23.98. The formula is four tenths of a percent for every dollar that you're over. So you would multiply 0.004 times 23. If you want to think of it very simply, if that were $25 and you were multiplying times 0.04, this would come out to precisely 10%. But it's not quite, so it comes out to just under 10%. But the progressivity is 10%. And it's added to the 25%, and then it's multiplied times everything. Sometimes people say, gee, the first $30 isn't subject to progressivity. That's not an accurate way of characterizing it. It's that the first $30 doesn't trigger progressivity. Once you've triggered progressivity, you multiply it times the entire tax base. So in this case, you've generated 34%. You go back and you multiply that times the $12 billion, and the total tax that would be due for the standalone oil is 4.2 or 4.174, I'm going to round it, $4.2 billion. So that's what would happen in a year in which basically you just had oil and this is all based on, you know, roughly speaking, assume there's sort of one big company on the North Slope. Clearly, you have three taxpayers that are paying the vast majority of this, a couple taxpayers paying small slivers of it. Now, let's think for a minute what happens when we add gas. And what I'm going to do to sort of help people think through this for a minute is do a thought experiment and come up with what I call the standalone gas number, which actually has no meaning under the law, but it's a way perhaps that people think about it or maybe have thought about it when they were thinking about the gas line, saying, well, I'll try to isolate a piece of this and figure out what it is. I've used a figure of 4.2 BCF a day. I think some of the proposals we've heard going around are higher, 4.5. But to be very frank, what I did is I just chose a number that when I had converted it to barrel of oil equivalents, I would be splitting 50-50. I would have the equal number of hydrocarbons in terms of energy value in gas as in oil. And that's about right. I mean, when people talk about what the gas line is going to be, if it comes anything close to how it's currently being described, energy equivalent-wise, it'll be about 700,000 barrels a day equivalent of oil. It's the same.
We can just stop there just for, I know a lot of this is, we went over this morning and stuff, but coming attractions later this afternoon, we're going to vary the ratio of gas to oil and increase the complexity a little bit. So don't go to sleep on the redundancy.
Mr. Chairman, you've probably looked ahead of my slides. Yes, that's one of the things that I do. And this, again, was particularly chosen as an illustration because a 50-50 mix yields the biggest interactive result. And that's, I'm not claiming this as a typical example. I'm using this as an illustration. So, again, you have 4.2 BCF a day or billion cubic feet yields a 1,500 billion cubic feet a year in a billion cubic feet of oil. You translate that into barrels, it's the 255. I'm going to go back to thinking about things as thousands of cubic feet because that's how sort of the numbers that people are used to seeing and hearing and quoting. And again, another assumption hidden here is that each 1,000 cubic feet that we've got energy of a million BTUs per 1,000 cubic feet. And in fact, North Slope Gas is a little bit different than that, but for sort of the back of the envelope calculations, that ratio works just fine. So what was it selling for in Henry Hub? $6.08. That's a well-publicized number. The efficiencies of the market that Commissioner Galvin talked about have sort of established maybe as a transportation cost. The difference between the ACO hub and the Henry hub that has varied over time. I'm using 75 cents there. That's a number. The 288 was taken from a TransCanada presentation at the time as an estimate of what that cost might be. And so if you take that $6 selling price, what that really ends up at the point of production, in other words, back at the boundary lease in Alaska, is each 1,000 cubic feet, each MCF, is worth $2.45. So again, you then take the $2.45, you multiply it times the volume, and that's about $3.7 billion. So right off, you can see there's something going on here because we had two equivalent energy streams. If you put them in an incinerator, burn them, and use them to run a machine, you get the same amount of each, but one of them, people are willing, you know, the net back value to us is $18.7 billion. The net back value of the other one is $3.7 billion. Much, much smaller. Gas simply isn't worth what oil is on a energy equivalent basis. Now, in these examples, I have pushed all the upstream costs onto oil. I think that's the most, in terms of the thing I'm trying to illustrate, that's the most conservative assumption. We can talk about later how those will be allocated. If they're allocated at all, but to the degree that if you think about Prudhoe Bay, for example, there's a cost to run that field, and when the gas comes on and is sold, it isn't going to make much difference in what it costs to run the field, because right now we're already taking almost 9 billion cubic feet a day up out of the ground, putting it through the central gas facility, extracting some gas liquids, and it goes over to the central compressor plant, which is the largest such kind of plant in the world. Pressure it all back up, put it back down in the ground to maintain the pressure. If instead at that last step, you could simply take it, put it into a gas line, and push it into to Canada or down to Valdez, you'd essentially be ready. So the cost of moving the gas is currently borne by the oil, and if that some of that gas is exported, it's not really going to take the costs anywhere. How you allocate them might change. So how do you convert this now figure out the tax on it? And again, I want to emphasize, this is a hypothetical calculation because this is not called for in the law anyplace. Or you can think about this, and what if I was a new producer who was not producing any oil, and I was just up there producing gas? What would it look like? Well, when you divide the $3.2 billion through by the BOE equivalent, you come out to $14.70 per barrel equivalent. Clearly, you're way below $30. No progressivity is triggered on the gas. So if you want to sort of continue this thought experiment, you'd say, okay, I'm going to take 25% of it, and my standalone, the tax on the gas would be about $800 million. But that's not what the law does. I think as the commissioner went through this morning, what the law does is it goes back and it says, okay, we're going to look at the taxable value of everything. We're going to look at how much taxable value came from oil, in this case $12 billion, how much came from gas, and we're going to add it together. So the taxable value for the North Slope is about $15 billion. We go through the exact same calculation. We take out the royalty piece. We look at the taxable BOE left, divide through, and you come out with $34.34 per BOE. That's much closer to $30. When you subtract the $30 and go to trigger progressivity, you're only generating 1.74% in additional progressivity. That compares with 9% progressivity when the oil was standing alone. As a consequence of that, of course, the tax rate is only 26%, not 34%. The amount of tax generated is $4.1 billion. That's less tax than was generated by the oil alone. So that's how, and I think this is no different from it's a different month, but I think the concept is precisely what the commissioner walked you through this morning, which is when you add a bunch of lower value gas into an oil stream, the tax is going to go down. The combined tax on the two is going to be lower than the oil stream alone. Now, what I've done, and the commissioner took it one step further, talked about credits. I think if you remember, credits are going to change the total dollars, but the relationships are going to be the same because they're just an amount you subtract. It's how you go to pay the tax. Once you figure out what the total tax burden is, you take a credit instead of writing a check, but it's not going to affect these relationships I'm talking about here. As I said earlier, there are two ways of measuring this effect. And in this case, they're the two different boxes here. One of them, which is probably the one that makes, I think, folks have focused on, is to say, okay, if we just had the oil and then we add gas in, how much tax revenue would we lose? Or put another way, Mr. Chairman, to use a phrase you used earlier, if we said, okay, we're going to give the gas away, we're going to say it's not taxable at all, zero tax on the gas, how much better off would we be than if we actually taxed the gas? In other words, if the gas were not taxable and not part of the progressivity equation, how much further ahead would we be? The second number here is simply comparing the difference between, you know, if you had done a standalone calculation, said, okay, I know how much my oil is going to be taxed, and then did the same thing for gas, and said, I know how much my gas tax is going to be, and you add the two together, you would have expected an additional $800 million when you added the oil gas, and so you'd have roughly $5 billion, 4.99, and this second number here is simply measuring the difference between these two standalone calculations, hypothetical, they're thought experiments because they're not in the statute if a producer is producing both these hydrocarbon quantities, but it takes the difference between those and what you're actually getting and say, okay, you know, that's a measurement of how much the combination is driving down the tax level.
I think what we want to do is kind of speed along here and okay. Kind of point out the differences between the administration.
Fair
otherwise,
enough.
We're going to get bogged down and
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will do that.
We spent a week on the tax structure, so we understand the tax structure.
Okay. I will not walk you through any more tax structure. The next slide just simply shows numbers from January 2010, and as the chairman just requested, I won't walk you through it. You can see down the two boxes the equivalent things. You are the tax is lower as a consequence if a gas line came on.
And those are actual January 2010 market values?
Those are 2010 market values. The TransCanada gave a presentation, I believe, in this room about within this last month. They said the tariff is going to range someplace between 280 and 350. I took the most favorable of those, the thing that's going to leave you the most value in gas, which was the 280. If you do the 350, and you look here on the calculation, I think you can see you'd be down, the gas value would be about a dollar and something, and you'd have considerably less effect. You have a larger drop as a consequence of adding oil to the progressivity because there'd be so much less value being added.
Okay. So this isn't a hypothetical run. This is actually January numbers. In the market relationship.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is assuming a gas project came on, and so in that sense it's hypothetical, but it's using numbers that anyone can look up on web or in the newspaper on a website or something, yes. The next picture is for those, some folks look at the numbers and it's all blurry, but this will make a lot more sense. Other folks look at pictures and they say, well, tell me what your real numbers behind it are. So, Mr. Chairman, I can just take a moment to walk through it. But what this tries to show graphically is why you get this effect. And fundamentally, again, real numbers, this was June of 2008, you had a $12 gas price at Henry Hub. If you translate the 1,000 cubic feet into a BOE of gas, basically you multiply everything times 6, what that means is you essentially had, 6 times 1268 brings you out to about, $73, $74. This hypothetical barrel that's composed of 6,000 cubic feet of gas sold for about $72. It had a cost, because the tariff, again, times 6, of about $30. Again, we don't worry about the upstream allocation. That's a whole separate issue. But the point is, when you put that $30 collar on top, basically you have wiped out any progressivity resulting from the gas. You have a tiny, tiny sliver, about $1.50 for that BOE, subject to progressivity, subject to the progressivity driver. You compare that to the oil price, which was $133, subtract out the downstream cost, the upstream cost, you put on the $30 trigger, and what you're left with is, roughly speaking, $80 that is going to drive progressivity. If you had the same number of BOEs of oil at roughly $1.50 and the gas at $80, you can see that the combination of the two is going to be $41. It's going to be half. It's going to be much smaller. And given the way that progressivity formula works, as you back off of a high number, the progressivity drops very, very rapidly. So, I gave this presentation the first time, laid out some of these numbers roughly a year ago, and the folks from Gaffney Klein, I've got a number of Gaffney Klein slides in here that I borrowed without their permission, but I assume they won't be too angry about that. But basically, and here's how they, representing the administration, responded to the issues as they were raised a year ago. The first thing is...
Just hold a second. I think this presentation was given to joint resources and finance joint in resources, as I recall.
Mr. Chairman, I believe I presented it to the LB&A committee, to a joint meeting of Senate Resources and Senate Finance, and then a third presentation to maybe a standalone finance committee. Or standalone resources, perhaps.
Standalone resources, but we can sort that out and get back to the committee.
And one of the elements that I think is important to talk about in the history is that, in fact, the basic elements driving this were part of the 2006 reforms, the switch from a gross tax to a net tax. And just to go back a little bit in history, I think if folks recall 4 years ago, and I realize not everyone was here there, but the focus was on crafting a tax on oil. There was sort of this ring fence. Nobody wanted to talk about the gas because any day now, the stranded gas contract would be released, and that dealt with the gas. And the whole issue was, how are we going to tax oil when that stranded gas contract is in effect or the period leading up to it? How are we going to tax that very small amount of gas that's used for things other than is in a gas line? So the focus was on how will we tax oil, and that's really where the notion, the progressivity notion, and the parameters that are used in it develops. Now, Gaffney-Klein spoke about, and this is good. This is a Gaffney-Klein slide in which they show other Gaffney-Klein slides that they had shown earlier. But their point was, yeah, we meant to do it this way. This was part of the plan. And they, again, used the same words I've used. You have a cross-subsidy created by progressivity, whereby essentially when you produce gas, the oil taxes go down. The cross-subsidy goes between one of the hydrocarbons to the other. And their point is, and again, you know, they talked about lower profitability developments and your effective rate being lower than the base rate. And, you know, don't know that everyone tied that together to know that, understand that those words lead to this notion of you bring on a lower cost profitability development, i.e. a gas line, and the net result is that your base tax is lower than it would have been without that project. And they say, and I absolutely agree with the very bottom note there, and I think everyone's saying the same thing, you have to look at a wide range of expected values. You can't just focus on a narrow range, and I think some of the things that we found out in the last couple of years is sometimes we can't even imagine before the event how wide that range should be. One of the things that they talked about was pricing parity, another expression you've heard. This Gaffney-Klein slide says that one way to predict the future is to look at the past. And so they looked back 14 years and said, gee, if you look at it, you know, here's six. It was a little bit higher, generally six or eight, but that looks like the general, there's the range you see for the last 14 years. What's happened in the intervening year, and when this presentation was given, we were right about here, it was about a year ago. You can see that there was a dip, but then we had some event, some occurrence, and it turns out that the past was not a particularly good predictor of the future, or at least the prior 14 years weren't a good predictor of the next 2 years. Again, on the same subject, their point was, in my demonstration, I used a parity ratio of 13 to 1, and that had occurred less than 4% of the time in the past 14 years, which I agree with that analysis. And what's happened, of course, in the year since then is the value has never fallen below 14. And we've had to add, you know, new numbers here as we went up to 18 to 22 to almost hit 26. So, again, the part of the criticism of looking at this notion of, gee, we're gonna lose, potentially lose money with a gas line, lose revenues, the two focuses were, yeah, where that happens, it's a subsidy, so it's part of the design, but it's probably not going to happen much because Mr. Dickinson used an extreme set of values. And I think those are the two points I want to focus on. This graphic, which is also from Gaffney-Klein, and actually I wish I had thought of it. I think it's a very good way of representing the issue. I think it lays it out very clearly. Basically, what this shows is the bottom is the green is the oil standalone tax. So if you think back to that diagram we went through, no matter what happens, no matter how much sort of gas oil is selling for, if you didn't have any gas, here's what your tax would be, $4.2 billion. Let's assume you then introduce some gas, a gas project, and if gas is selling at a 5-to-1 ratio, in other words, where gas is more valuable than oil on a BTU basis, you would then generate an additional roughly $8 billion in taxes, and you generate that if you were doing a standalone calculation, figuring out the hypothetical number, but this blue line says what would happen under the Alaska tax system. And yeah, you would also generate that $12 billion of tax. As you move down this line, if you move along the x-axis, if you move to your right and you move towards the values that we have been seeing over the past several years, clearly even at that time you were moving down, what you will see is in the beginning, when oil-gas parities are in the 5, 6, 7, the single-digit range, what you will see is the amount of tax lost, the amount of dilution, is very minimal. But what you'll start to see when you hit about 9 or 10 or 13 is the amount of red above the blue line is the amount of gas tax that isn't captured, and the amount below is the amount of gas tax that is captured. So right about 13 is right about the point at which, again, you can think of this, if you will, as declaring the gas tax-free. saying we're not going to tax any, we're not going to tax anything on the, no tax on the gas. That it just doesn't form part of the tax system. We're just going to tax you all. You can do what you want on the gas. No additional checks are necessary. And then as you continue to move down this line here towards 14 and 15, the amount of green showing shows how much less oil tax you're collecting or how much less total tax you're collecting as a consequence of having added the gas line. In other words, you're no longer collecting the amount you would have collected just with a standalone. The project is coming on and adding, taking, subtracting value from the taxes. Folks will probably figure out what the next slide's going to look like, but basically, you know, if you go out to the kind of values that we saw at least 1 month in the past year, what you'll see is, you know, what this represents, for example, at this point is to say, gee, if you were collecting $4 billion in taxes with a gas line, excuse me, without a gas line, and you suddenly add the gas line in, it's here, great, what happens? Your tax revenues fall by $1 billion. You're only collecting $3 billion. And with this set of numbers, and obviously when you're talking about a parity ratio at 25, the gas is very cheap, there's not much royalty. At this kind of level, it's as the phrase you used earlier, Commissioner, you're giving the gas away. You're saying the amount you're collecting is less, less tax, and the amount less of tax you're collecting more overwhelms the royalty that would be paid, because as I say, this would be a very cheap gas. So the notion here is, as the relevant range that folks were examining was sort of back here when we went out and examined it a little bit further out, that was sort of posited as being outside the range. But I think what this suggests is this entire range is worth thinking about. And again, I think Dr. Wood will talk about this later or may make the observation. This shows what's happened, and there's no reason to think that the next time we have an expansion or some event, that the parity may not even get more extreme. So the contention here that I'm trying to show is you really are in a situation where if you hit these kind of parities, there's no question that the gas, adding gas to the state's fiscal system and taxing it, will result in less tax, not more.
So, Mr. Dickinson, I guess one of the things that we haven't talked about is, do we pay them monthly? How does this work when we pay them to take our gas?
Chair Stedman, there is still a net cash flow to the state. And so what we're really saying, and it's a rhetorical device, if you will, is that the amount of tax has fallen so much, they would still pay a royalty, you'd still get a royalty check. It's just, it would be very small, and it would be a lot smaller than the amount of tax you had lost. So for example, these are paid monthly. The production tax and the royalties are both paid monthly. That's basically the state's cash flow. It's where all the checks are written from, so the Treasury ends up getting several hundred million dollars a month, and that would fall. The amount of tax revenue would fall significantly. The amount of royalty would actually go up a hair, but the difference between them is such that you still have a net total loss in revenues to the Treasury. The next observation that was made by Gaffney Klein, again, it's an accurate one, is that part of the problem with this model is, I said, gee, what if a gas line miraculously appeared tomorrow when we're producing 700,000 barrels a day? That's probably give or take a decade or two. When a gas or if a gas project does show up, the state's probably not going to be producing anywhere near 700,000 barrels a day. I think you saw Commissioner Galvin adjusted those numbers down to 500,000 a day. Other times, other ones that I've used and presented, and Mr. Chairman, there are some slides at the end of this presentation, which are slides I had presented earlier. I'm not going to go through them, but they're here. People don't want to go back to the older presentations. And the notion is I used a 350, so cut the volume in half of oil. I think what I've tried to do in the next slide is to sum up and sort of show, again, at a given price, how that works. And what really is happening is, when the oil and the gas volumes are equal, that's when you have the maximum dilution at a given price. And if you move the amount of gas You decrease the amount of oil moving off to the right here. So instead of being equal, you have 90%, 80, 70, 60, 50. You will see that the size of the effect, the loss to the state, gets smaller. Similarly, if instead of bringing on the full 4.5 BCF a day, we brought on 90% of that, or 80, or 70, or 60, the amount of loss to the state would decrease. So again, I have used numbers which have purposely focused on the maximum. The situation we're in, or likely to be in a decade or two from now, probably would be further out here on the right-hand axis, and would be, you know, oil would be at 60 or 50% of what it is today, and so the effect would not be so dramatic. It's still there. It's just the amount of progressivity you generate on fewer barrels is simply smaller than the amount you generate on more barrels, and so that's why that effect occurs this way. The summary from Gaffney-Klein were three things, and I think they really teed the issues up very well. The first one is they said there's a range of possible outcomes caused by ACEs. We identified the structure, and you have incentives. And the question that I would ask is, are these well-targeted incentives? In other words, when you have a very high oil price, and remember, the folks who are producing most of the oil are going to be the same folks that are producing most of the gas. When you have very high oil prices, is that an appropriate time for a very large tax subsidy? When evaluating ACEs and a possible gas line, reasonable results are obtained when real-world input values are used. And so I simply took that notion and expanded the world to use the years, the real inputs we've seen over the last year. But I think that the point that I think is important to note is that the reasonable results include very material potential tax revenue losses from a gas line, where you add a gas line and the net effect is your taxes go down. The last point there, it says nobody has brought forth expected sustainable scenarios to show that ACEs needs to be modified. So, I leave that up to you, Mr. Chairman, to figure out whether that's appropriate or not, whether the issues, in fact, lead to that conclusion. But that leads me to my next slide, which is let's assume that you look at that and you say, okay, this needs to be fixed. This is not an intended result. And I want to kind of lay out two paths here, although the commissioner laid out a third, but I'm going to focus on the two that are here because his is really a subset of this. So one thing you can do, and Mr. Chairman, you've talked about this, and is go in and change AS 4355, but do it before the open season. And so there's this notion that you're going to capture the taxes that were in the open season, and that's somehow going to be preserved. But the other thing, I think this is very important, is, and the metaphor I've used with a couple of people is, there's been a lot of talk here in the regulations, and everyone's focused on the front door, and we've got a deadbolt on it, and a combination lock, and a key, and a safety behind it. But all the windows, and the back door, and the chimney, and the side door are unlocked. There's nothing that says you simply can't go into the income tax, or into AS 43, you know, AS 4352 or 53, or, you know, simply go and write a new statute that says, gee, here's this multi-billion-dollar project out there, it's moving along, state short of revenue, we're going to put a tax on the pipeline, we're going to put a tax on the producers. If you did that work in AS 4355, then you'd have the formulas and everything that the commissioner went through. But if you do it outside of 4355, and there's no prohibition on that, the state is certainly free to put as heavy taxes as the burden they want on this project at any time going forward. So, and I just, you know, I mean, the point I want to bring to people's attention is to go in there and focus on AGEA. What does AGEA say? What is preserved for 10 years? It is your gas production tax. And then the statute goes on to say, in this section, the gas production tax means the tax levied on the production of gas under AS 4355. But there's nothing to say that you can level a tax on anything else. I mean, quite frankly, one of the things you'd have to be worried about is you can't take a chapter that's already been used for something that's been repealed. And as folks who have been through the history well know, we've had several other oil and gas taxes that served their purpose, did something for a couple of years, and have subsequently been repealed. And so the point here is that, locking down the current production taxes, indeed, there's some debate about how locked down they are. The commissioner said, what I heard him say was that you have the ability to come in and change the law that says they're locked down. But I'm not focusing on that point. I'm simply saying leave AS 4355 aside. These kind of issues can be solved if the, you know, if the legislature believes that it's that the gas project is an appropriate place to raise the revenue or to compensate for too much leakage, for example, if they believe that the gas oil price ratios were such that they're not getting the revenues they expected, then they are free to go and levy that additional tax. And that sort of leads back into this whole notion of how much fiscal stability there is there. But I would suggest if the legislature is focused on raising revenue, they're not going to get into any of the ratios that Commissioner Galvin was going through. You're going to leave 4355 aside. You know, why get into the complications? You'll do a clear revenue-raising statute someplace else.
Okay. We're going to – that finishes you up?
That finishes me up, Mr. Chairman. These other slides are ones I just I simply have to put this next slide into every presentation because I think it's the most dramatic one and everything else has been seen before.
We're going to have a brief at ease while we set up for Dr. Wood, but just on your last comment, I think that there's more of an interest, not so much to increase state revenue, but to make sure we don't have a as you said, a leakage where we have an erosion of our entire gas revenue stream. We're at ease. Back from recess, we have I think what we're gonna do here, we've got, depending on questions, though, we've got about 60 slides. I think the information is more valuable than the time it takes, so we're gonna work through this. I'll check the clock about 4 o'clock in an hour, and we'll see how close we are, and then about 4:30, I'll look at trying to wrap it up. And what we haven't got done, we'll pick up in the morning because I don't want everybody to get too tired and remember the information. And and there'll be a lot of information here. I think the committee will find it very interesting. With us is Dr. David Wood, who
Mr. Chairman,
second Senator Hoffman.
If that's the case, then we'll probably take up the two hearings on the budgets that we had scheduled for 3 o'clock, delayed till 4, and have them at 4:30.
Okay, we'll shoot for 4:30 on this. Okay. So the we'll stop no later than a little bit before 4:30. depending on how things go here. So we have with us Dr. Wood. And Dr. Wood, if you could, he is a consultant for legislative budget and audit. The legislature had hired Dr. Wood a year and a half ago. About a year and a half ago, to help us with oil and gas tax structure in the basin, and to help us when we have gas issues in front of us and alternatives. And with that, I'd like Dr. Wood to just go ahead and introduce himself and briefly tell the Alaska public who you are and where you're from, and then when you get all that taken care of, we'll get down to business and run through the presentation.
Okay, well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Senators. My name is David Wood. I'm an independent international consultant working on fiscal design and gas projects around the world. I think what I bring to the party is the independence piece, in the sense that I'm not representing the administration. I don't represent any of the oil and gas companies, and I'm not a resident in Alaska, so it gives me the opportunity to look at this issue from a slightly more detached position, I think, than the many of the others that perhaps you've heard. So I think it perhaps is worth putting that in context, that in what I'm going to present.
Can you slide the microphone just a little bit closer? And
okay. All right.
And I just want a note for the public, Dr. Wood had flown up and down the coast of Alaska for 2 days, I think, trying to get here. It was quite an ordeal. And I do want to thank Alaska Airlines. So we had made a call to Alaska Airlines to encourage him to try to find a seat for Dr. Wood. He'd come from London and trying to keep the committee on schedule. So it was nice that Alaska Airlines did what they could to get him here on time.
Yeah, I very much appreciated that help on Monday. Okay, well, my presentation structure is to begin with a bit of background. What are the issues for Alaska's fiscal regime when applied to gas? And then to look at the fiscal designs of some other countries. These are a selected few countries, but I think it will be clear why I've selected those. Then to look at some of the risks and opportunities for international gas suppliers. Now, at that point, I'm going to move into the prevailing Alaska fiscal design and make a few observations about it in terms of its relevance to other international designs, and then come back to this issue of the complications associated with combining oil and gas in the progressivity tax, which I've referred to in some of the slides as CPT, combined progressivity tax. I'm also going to make the point that we've seen quite a lot of models that look at individual snapshots of what is a price of oil, what is a price of gas, what happens when you combine those. But in the real world of evaluating oil and gas projects, whether you're a producer or whether you're a government concerned with fiscal design, you really do need to look at multi-year, multi-scenario models. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, because sometimes we can get a bit sidetracked with looking at just snapshots. And based on that, I will bring that together in some conclusions and some recommendations. Okay, well, let's begin with what are the issues of the Alaska for Alaska's fiscal regime when applied to gas? And I think it's worth stating here that fiscal issues are one of several factors. They're by no means the only factor that will determine whether Alaska's gas will make it to a market in the lower 48. In this slide, I'm showing, as I'm sure you're aware, that there is gas potentially coming from many other sources into the United States. There is gas, unconventional gas, particularly shale gas, coalbed methane, within the lower 48s that's receiving a lot of investment. There's deep water Gulf of Mexico gas. And as we see, there are potential sources of liquefied natural gas from many areas of the world. Clearly, fiscal issues are important because each one of those countries has a different fiscal regime pertaining to gas. I think what is interesting is that the major US companies that are operating here in Alaska are involved in most of those countries. They're in recent years and in recent months, they have sanctioned multi-billion dollar investments in many of these countries associated with major gas projects. And clearly, you have to ask the question, why have they sanctioned those projects in those countries and not yet sanctioned the project in Alaska? So we're focused here on fiscal issues, but we do have to recognize that there are many other issues. I think it's useful to put the North American gas market, certainly the import gas market, in the global context. In this slide, which I put together a little more than a year ago, it looks at what volumes of gas are imported by the various major gas importing regions. And we can see that North America is a relatively small part of the international gas imports market. The Europe, OECD Pacific, of which, of course, Japan, Korea are the big players there, are more significant. And, of course, on the right of that diagram, China and potentially India are going to grow quite rapidly. In the intervening year, I would say that those two forecasts for North America, 2020 and 2030, look a little bit optimistic, if anything, and the OECD Pacific bars on that chart look a little pessimistic. But overall, I think it shows that North America is a relatively small gas import market relative to the other main markets. Now, lots of information on this slide, but these are some of the large LNG sale and purchase agreements. So that's binding long-term agreements that have been struck. Sorry, it's not just binding. There's some are binding, some of them are heads of agreements, but they are a large volume, long-term duration, 25 to 20 years, signed by a range of companies here, but you know, the names that you'll be familiar with, ExxonMobil, Chevron, involved in many of those. The projects from where that gas is coming from, Gorgon projects in Australia, other projects in Australia, Papua New Guinea, but other projects in Qatar, and also we see the project from Western Canada there, the Kitimat project, with a memorandum of understanding, but still it has potential gas buyers. And you know, the significance here is that there is a lot of big deals being done. Some of the off-takers there, well, Japan is a key off-taker, but China is also involved in big volumes on that list. And you know, it's been said, well, the gas market is has taken a downturn since the economic recession. Well, I would say if you look at the dates of mid-2009 to the end of 2009 on that diagram, that doesn't tell me that there isn't a big enthusiasm both by the gas buyers and the international oil companies to enter into long-term gas agreements. So both of those recognize that there is demand and a requirement for gas in the international arena. This diagram shows some of the big projects that are coming on stream and about to come on stream in the LNG world. In fact, the Ras Gas 3 there in Qatar, the train number one, came on stream today. In fact, so it's a topical term there. We can see that Qatar is responsible for about 50% of the gas that's coming on stream there. ExxonMobil is the foreign partner involved in both RasGas and Qatargas, with you know, between 20 and 30% equity interest, with Qatar Petroleum having a very large equity interest. But notice there are a number of LNG projects coming on over the next few years. I put some arrows on that diagram showing when this diagram was put together last year, those projects hadn't yet been sanctioned, the Australia projects. But we have several projects in Australia, Papua New Guinea, either sanctioned already or about to be sanctioned or expected to be sanctioned this year. So Australasia has made a big impact. Just to put into context, between November and December 2009, the volume of international LNG supply in the market increased by 12% worldwide. So the LNG supply is increasing very rapidly, and not only is this due to major investments over the past few years, we can see going forward there are big projects, multi-billion, tens of billion projects that are being sanctioned. Okay, well, let's come back now to the North American market. We'll put that to one side for the moment, but we'll come back particularly to some of those projects in Australasia. Gas imports in the U.S. Increased for many years, from the 1990s through to 2007. We can pinpoint on this diagram somewhere second half of 2007, those gas imports started to fall for the first time. And the reason for that is primarily the impact of shale gas in the lower 48. And shale gas has had a big impact, as well as the economic recession in terms of lowering demand on the North American gas market, as you're all aware. And that has also had a big impact on imports into the US. If we look here at LNG imports into the US, The biggest year of imports, 2007, is shown there. If we look at 2008 and 2009, we can see that LNG imports fell substantially. So the US market is certainly out of sync with the rest of the world in terms of its appetite for LNG at the moment, and shale gas is the key factor. But it's not just LNG that's impacted. If we look at Canada gas, we have to face that Canada is a major competitor with Alaska in bringing gas into the lower 48. I would say that Canada has had the biggest impact on this downturn of gas demand and the impact of shale gas. If you look at the 2009 volumes imported from Canada there, we just see the magnitude of that drop in volumes over that period. Now, because of the economic recession and because of all these big projects, particularly the Qatar projects coming on stream, from the LNG perspective, and also the downturn in demand in the US, there is forecast probably through to 2013, perhaps a bit longer, that there will be a surplus of LNG in the global market. Now, put that together with shale gas, and the expectation is that we're probably in for a period of low international gas prices and relatively low gas prices in North America. Now, you know, that of course is a crucial period, because the sanctioning of the Alaska gas line is going to be taking place during a period where gas prices, not just in North America but worldwide, are probably going to be lower than they have been for the previous decade. However, if we look forward from that, beyond 2014 going forward to 2020, many, and this is my forecast, which suggests that there's going to be a deficit of gas internationally, which should push prices up. But you know, my forecast is no different from many other observers. And I think the fact that China and Japan are signing those big contracts for large volumes that we saw on the earlier slide, I think a testament that those countries recognize that they're going to have to secure that gas now. Many of the projects that they're signing that gas for are due to come on stream 2014 through to 2016. So I think we shouldn't be too dismayed at the current gas prices or the gas prices over the next few years. We need to look forward to what is happening in the world, and when the Alaska gas line comes on stream. At the moment, it looks as though gas demand and prices are going to be much more robust. So we have there is a big mistake in a project as big as the Alaska gas line to get too bogged down in what are the prices today, what is that going to mean for the long-term value of the pipeline. We need to look at a much wider range of oil and gas prices. We've heard this morning and earlier this afternoon about the price parity issue, and on this slide I've plotted that parity issue using the EIA figures on the left-hand side of this diagram, going back to 1970s, when of course those high parity figures up above 20 were due to price control prior to a deregulated market. But we can see, as Dan Dickinson explained earlier, that those parity numbers in recent years in recent months have risen to levels of above 20. Now, if we lock ourselves into that range in there, that's around about the 6 to 8, which some of the slides that were shown earlier today focused upon, and do all our planning and fiscal design based on those assumptions, I believe that we're making a huge mistake. If we look at the EIA's forecast going forward, and all that we know about a forecast is that it's likely to be wrong, but there is some purpose in looking at these forecasts, in that if the forecasts are suggesting that parities are over the period 2015 through to 2030 are all above 15, then it seems that if we do our tax planning with a parity of 6 to 8 in mind, we may be getting things dramatically wrong. My view is that we need to look at our fiscal design and stress test it in as wide a range as possible. And as I'll show you later, I'm looking at parities from 2 to 30. I think the range we saw this morning was something like 6 to 16, I don't think it's wide enough. Why don't I think it's wide enough? Because that doesn't mean to say that I think that the parity is going to be above 20 for the next 30 years. But my point is that we only need a price spike in a couple of these years where parities go above 20, and the rest of the time it may well be down below 10. But in those price spikes, we can see some significant impacts on gas value that we need to understand, because if those those price spikes in oil combined with very high parities, as we've seen already, will lead to a cross-subsidy dilution that will be significant. And I think Alaska is fully aware that, you know, in 2007 and 2008, it raised significant revenue from the oil price spike and is aware that low gas prices would have significantly reduced that value over the space of a few months. So looking at a forecast and saying, well, we're taking this average for 30 years, in my view, is not the way to plan. You need to look at wide ranges. And that I think is what I'm proposing here. Okay, well, what are the fiscal designs applied by other countries? And then what are some of the risks and opportunities associated with them? And simplistically, there are two sets of fiscal designs that operate around the world. The mineral interest or concessionary systems, as we have here in many and in many other OECD countries, and the contractual systems, the production sharing agreements. Now, there is some relevance in the production sharing agreements, but I'm going to put that to one side here and look at some countries that have mineral interest systems with similar structures but different fiscal elements within them. And I think we can get some insight from that. Now, the three countries that I'm going to put up here are Norway, Australia, and Papua New Guinea. And they're selected. Why have I selected them? These are three countries where the major oil and gas companies are sanctioning big investment projects. They're countries where gas projects are expensive. Two of them are offshore. One of them, Papua New Guinea, is onshore. And we talk about high cost and difficult conditions in Alaska, but these countries also have substantial cost issues, substantial environmental issues that make their projects run into billions of dollars. Now, I'm not going to read or go through all the words on this slide. I put these three slides up for background, but I'm going to make the point that in each of these cases, they have progressive fiscal systems. That means that they don't have a lot of fiscal elements in there that cause projects to become uneconomic when prices are low or costs are very high. They also have some incentives in these systems. Norway has introduced investment uplift and has some credits involved that, over the past decade, it's managed to attract many companies, both large and small, to invest in Norway as a consequence of providing those inducements. But those inducements are very much focused on the marginal field and low cost and price environments. Also in Norway, the state is heavily involved. It's through its state-owned or partially state-owned company, Statoil. It has an equity interest in almost all of the developments, and the state take is somewhere close to 80%, higher than Alaska, but it still manages to attract a wide range of international companies to invest. Papua New Guinea, and of course this is of interest because of the Papua New Guinea LNG project. Big onshore gas discoveries made back in the 1980s. ExxonMobil, the operator and key player there with partners. Originally, that project started off as a pipeline project. It spent some 10 years going through the motions of trying to get a pipeline. It has now ended up as an LNG project, and you know, final investment decision is expected this year. The fiscal system is, again, progressive. It has progressivity or similar to progressivity components involved in there. And there is also, as part of the deal, a negotiated fixed term of stability. I don't know the details of that, but it's a key aspect to the deal that has been struck. And you know, crucially, long-term contracts have been obtained. Let's look at Australia, and this is where you know, in excess of 40 billion have been committed in the past few months. Again, it is a progressive system. It's moved away from a volume and royalty-based system into a progressive fiscal system. It has uplift on costs and credits within the system, and we can see that, that even in the remote Northwest Shelf areas, very high costs, very remote from market, it is managing to secure investments from all of the major IOC companies. In addition to these projects, there are big onshore projects in Queensland, coal seam methane projects in which the major US companies, ConocoPhillips, are involved in bringing these projects through to LNG projects expected to be sanctioned over the next couple of years. So I mention these systems because in the case of Australia, the fiscal take is quite similar to Alaska, and the projects in terms of cost are not so dissimilar from Alaska, and the distance to the market is a lot further than the distance to the lower 48. You know, China and Japan are a long way away from Australia. So I think it is relevant to think about these other designs when we think about Alaska. In this diagram, I'm putting some of the big gas reserve nations up, and the bubbles here are linked, the size of the bubbles are linked to proved gas reserves. Now, of course, we can only book proved gas reserves when we have an export route and a long-term contract or a contract to sell that gas. So Alaska on there is a relatively small bubble at the moment because there are relatively small proven gas reserves. Going forward, assuming the gas line's built by 2020, then you know that bubble should get substantially bigger, and also it should move substantially to the left, being a higher opportunity country because it has the export route and should be much more attractive for companies to invest. Clearly, there are a whole series of other countries on there. Notice Australia is there, Norway is there, and you know, part of the reason that I chose those countries for comparison is because they do sit in similar positions in terms of their risk perspective and opportunity perspective, and in terms of potentially the gas resources that they hold. Okay, with that background, and I will come back again to some of those international areas. Let's now look at Alaska's prevailing fiscal design, and of course you're all familiar with this, so I'm not going to go into this in great detail. Just to point out some key features that I think we need to consider. This diagram, I think, is helpful in that it highlights the different levels of the fiscal elements that are involved in the Alaska fiscal design. And as we work from left to right on this diagram, the further the right we go, the further towards the bottom line or net position that we get. Some of the abbreviations to the left there, the destination value, the point of production value, and the production tax value, the PTV, there are all key tax points that are relevant to the different taxes involved. The three points on the left of this diagram here, property taxes, royalties, and the tax floor that apply to the production tax, are the three elements that stand out as regressive elements. If you wanted to distinguish Alaska from Australia, Norway, and Papua New Guinea, you would have to say that these regressive elements are more significant in the Alaska fiscal design than they are in those countries that I mentioned. And we'll come back to that point because I think it's very important, because if you're going to give inducements to investing companies, where they need inducements is at this end of the scale. At the moment, with the combined progressivity tax, where we're providing inducements is at that end of the scale. And I know of no other country where they give inducements at this end of the scale. I think that makes Alaska quite unusual.
Stop there, hold that. I got to see where you're pointing.
Oh, sorry. I'm pointing at the progressivity end here is where, at the moment, this cross-subsidy is applying. What I'm suggesting is that it is more logical, and most countries, when they apply inducements, they apply them at this end of the design at the regressive elements.
Okay, thank you.
And the slide here summarizes what I consider to be the regressive elements and the progressive elements. We focused very much, and very much has been said, about progressivity and how it reduces the take of the producing companies. But remember, it only does that at times when prices are high, or I should say margins are high, because of course in high cost situations, sometimes prices aren't the only factor involved. But I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that if we're going to talk about inducements, it's really these areas that we need to think about. Now, I know that royalties, property taxes, the tax floors are very delicate issues into and how inducements can be provided there is something that requires careful thought. But I just make the point that it is very strange to see inducements rolled in to the fiscal structures at that end. So, again, this slide distinguishes those regressive elements. Of course, you do have an excellent system of investment credits that have a big impact on the production tax. But remember that production tax, if we go back two slides, is starting from the production tax volume. So those investment credits are limiting the regressivity in some ways, but not across the whole spectrum. My point is that if you're going to consider allowances here, it's to the regressive elements you should look. And when I say tougher progressivity terms, I mean that if you de-link oil and gas in progressivity, it is clearly going to make progressivity tougher for the producing companies. But as I will show you in a moment, they live with far tougher terms at that end of the scale in most other countries that they invest in. And it's at the regressive end that really both those companies and the projects in which they're investing, particularly those high cost and marginal projects, that will really benefit from those inducements. The inducements given at the progressivity end won't help investments being made in heavy oil, marginal fields, and when prices are low. And a diagram here just summarizing on a scale of what fiscal elements can be considered progressive, what fiscal elements are regressive, and the regressive ones are the ones to the left of this diagram. You know, starting with royalties here, and you know, what rears its head occasionally in Alaska is the idea of reserve taxes. Well, you know, things don't get much more regressive than that, but certainly this whole area here is the regressive area, and that will be the area where it will be most logical to pay attention to potential inducements, not at the at the other end. Now yesterday, ConocoPhillips put up a slide that was a little similar to this, and they made the comparison with the Gulf of Mexico that if you compared the take in Alaska as prices increase to the right, that take, the from green to blue there, where we have the producer take in blue, the state take in green, was significantly diminished by progressivity. And I think the term they used was that there was a de-link between risk and reward. Well, if you put on this, and they did have, I have to say, they had a scale on this side. I haven't put a scale, but conceptually, if you look at the yellow outline on there, that's the range of takes that you would expect from the large resource-holding countries. It's the large gas resource-holding countries, I think, where the comparison has to be made. And I've listed down at the bottom here just a few, and we could put quite a few more on that list, but where the producer take is substantially less than the Alaska take under the current system. Way down here towards the base of the yellow, we have very large state equity involvement. We have a lot of progressive taxes. And in some cases, we actually have price caps where when the price goes above a certain amount, you know, 95% of revenue goes to the state. Now, what is interesting is that in all of those countries, the major IOC companies all have big projects, and they're sanctioning new projects in many cases. Now again, the little boxes on here, I'm making the point that combined progressivity is effectively acting as a little bit of an inducement or cross-subsidy, because it's actually making that line, the blue to green, slightly higher than it would be without that cross-subsidy. But as we come into the lower price range here to the left, I think we can see where the projects become much less profitable, and in this particular case, you know, the producer is not getting any take there. What little return there is on those projects is all being consumed by the regressive elements of the fiscal design. It's in this area here where inducements could really help marginal projects in tough conditions secure investors. So I think that, you know, there's a couple of points to be made here. One, that the major companies are quite happy around the world to be involved in projects that offer a far lower return than Alaska's current fiscal design at this end, and also that putting a subsidy at this end it really doesn't make a lot of sense. Multi-year analysis, rather than just these snapshots, is really important. And the reason it's important for these tens of billions of dollars of projects are that you make the investments of tens of billions of dollars, you don't see any revenue for perhaps a decade or more into the future. And what is important is not just looking at the take in undiscounted terms. We need to look at that take over multiple years in discounted terms. And you know, there's a couple of features of discounting. Quite rightly, governments use lower discount rates than producing companies for for their risk exposures, etc. But also, remember that the producing companies are making most of the investments. So when we discount their multi-year cash flows, Because the investments are made in the earlier years, discounting is going to reduce those investments by a smaller amount. It's going to reduce the cash flows in the far out years by large amounts. And because they have higher discount rates, the impact of that is going to be greater than from the state's discount rate. So what I'm saying here is that the takes for the producing companies on a discounted cash flow basis are going to be lower than if we look at them in snapshots on an undiscounted basis. So again, this point we'll come back to when we think about multi-year models, but it is the reason why we do need to do multi-year models, because the timing issue is very important. And looking at a fiscal design, it's no good just saying, well, does it work now? We have to look at it, is it going to work over the 40-year life of the project when billions of dollars need to be invested up front by the investors? Okay, well, let's return now to the complications of combined oil and gas progressivity tax. And this is the issue that has consumed most of the discussion today, so I'm going to try not to go over ground that we've already covered. But clearly, the production tax value and on a combined progressivity stream, as we know, is substantially influenced by gas. We know the trigger points, etc. I think we've covered most of these points. The key point being the difference between the differentials on an oil stream and a gas stream, because those differentials are so high, as Dan Dickinson showed earlier, the impact of low-value gas is quite significant. We've looked at a model to look at the features of the production tax values of gas and oil. Now, my approach is a little different from the two previous speakers, in the sense that whereas they're looking quite rightly at what does it mean in snapshots of time, and that is very good for illustrative purposes, but I think it's important to look at what is the impact over a wide range of potential scenarios. Some of those scenarios may seem unrealistic, but it does help to explain the logic of the relationships and how stable those designs will be. So in this context, I'm looking at the dilution effect. By looking on the horizontal scale here, we have the oil production tax value over a very wide range. Production tax value is going up to the right there into the 300s. Not necessarily likely to occur, but here being shown to show the trend. On the vertical scale, we're looking at the difference between the oil and gas tax together, less the oil progressivity tax. When those lines are below the horizontal axis there on that diagram, it means that the dilution effect is in place. And we can see that really the range that perhaps is of most interest is in this area of the diagram. The central area there, going from oil production tax value from, say, 30 to about 100, let's say 200. We can see that there's some inflection points on those curves, and that, of course, is because of the nature of the progressivity calculation. The different curves represent different gas PTV values. Clearly, the lower that gas PTV value is relative to oil PTV, the greater the loss in terms of the cross-subsidy. Now, earlier in the week, Gaffney Klein presented a high-level Excel model in which it was an oil model explaining the Alaska fiscal design in terms of one barrel and one year period. Now, while I was stuck in Alaska in Seattle Airport earlier in the week, I played around with that model because I felt that what would perhaps be also interesting is not to just look at it as one barrel of oil, but seeing as we're mixing oil and gas, to look at it as one BOE. What I did with their model was add a few inputs, here being the parity between the gas prices there, set at 6 there, the fraction of gas to oil, so in the mix, and of course using the oil price that was already there, using that parity, generate a gas price, input a transportation cost for gas, and of course that 6 there is the generic BTU to BOE conversion. And with those few numbers added to the Gaffney-Klein model, I've effectively transformed that into a BOE model. And I'm going to put that model up in a moment and just show you the way I think this should be evaluated. So let me just switch to the Excel here. And okay, so that this is the model from Gaffney-Klein. Just with the only changes that I have made have been these extra inputs here, and if we scroll down, what the other inputs that I've made are a table here of variables, and I've got this on the next slide if you can't see it on the screen here. But when I mean that I think it's important to look at wide ranges, I'm looking at $20 a barrel oil price up to $300 oil price. Now, you know, when people talked about $150 oil price a couple of years ago, everyone thought they were crazy. Well, I think over a period of 40 years, $300 may not seem so crazy. At least we should see how our model performs under those sort of conditions. Again, I also think that gas price parity needs to be looked at. I've put a range of 2 to 30 there, and I've put the gas fraction effectively over the whole spectrum, from zero gas to 100% gas. And I've got the model set up with a base case of $85 oil price, a parity of 6, and a 0.5 gas fraction. Now, that is an input. A user can put anything they like in there and calculate what is the production tax value of those variables. Now, what I've done is I put a little macro in there that effectively calculates all combinations of that. So, in fact, there's 12 values in each of those columns. So, 12 times 12 by times 12, it calculates 728 values, and it's for each of the variables shown. So, yeah, if we the macro here, just kick the macro off, and we see all those numbers spinning around there. The point being is that it's calculating a wide range of numbers, a wide range of oil parities or gas price parities, oil and gas mixtures, and a range of prices. And what is interesting is to look at what is the outcome of that. So rather than just argue about, well, what is the gas price going to be, what is the parity going to be, let's look at the whole range. Now, what the macro does is just calculate those numbers for, it actually plots these out on a separate sheet. Let me go back again to the sheet here. What it's picking out are certain numbers from these columns here, so production tax value. It's picking out the state take values, so we can look at it's picking out about 6 numbers from each of those columns. Now, clearly, 1,728 numbers. I'm not going to subject you to the tables of numbers, but this lends itself to graphical analysis. So what I've done is graph those numbers, and I'm not going to run through all of this. I'm going to go back to the presentation and present to you the results of just one of those graphs. The point being is that this approach this approach of looking at wide ranges, I think, is very relevant to how we need to look at fiscal design. We want to look at, is it stable? How does it behave over the widest possible range of conditions? So all the modifications that I've made to the Excel sheet are shown here, and the different cells. And that's the table that drives the macro. And again, the variables that I've picked up in the macro are these ones. The one I'm going to focus on is production tax rate percent. I could have used any of the others here. The key point being here that if we plot that data up, and this is oil price on the horizontal axis, production tax percent, that's production tax percent includes base production tax and the progressivity component. And notice these values down on the zero here, they're the cases at the $20 oil price where we know the project isn't going to pay any productivity, any production tax, because effectively it's sub-commercial. So we don't have to worry too much about the ones along the bottom here. But what I've then separated out between the red and the blue, the red ones are the ones where the price parity is greater than 10. So remember, that's between 10 and 30. And also where the gas fraction is greater than 0.5. So these are the conditions, or in fact, it should be greater than equal to 0.5 and greater than equal to 10. These are the conditions in which you're likely to have the maximum effect of your cross-subsidy and gas dilution. And that, in effect, is what is shown. If we look at the red areas here, we see that they're all on the low side at any given price. They're all on the low side of the production tax range. What is significant is that with those, just by varying varying price parity and the mixture of oil and gas, we can end up with a huge range of production tax for all of these prices. What is also significant is that at this end, let's take the 200 rather than the extreme 300, is that where this effect has a great impact, we're talking about billions of dollars, whereas as we come further to the left at lower oil prices, the effect of that cross-subsidy is much, much smaller. So we're giving a huge subsidy at these high price situations. And again, I know of no other country where oil prices in today's terms going up to $150 or $200 a barrel, where a government will give a producer billions of dollars of subsidy through this kind of mechanism. So there's a lot more that I think could come out of this kind of modelling approach. This was the results of a few hours in Seattle Airport, but I think we can. I think we can probably see that approach is somewhat different to looking at the individual snapshots. Those individual snapshots are important, but they represent one particular possibility. What we need to understand is what is the whole spectrum of possibilities.
Okay, we want to just pause here for a minute. I just handed a note, just a clarification. I guess apparently the model that was used was an internal Department of Revenue model, not Gaffney-Klein. So it's, well, just a...
Okay, so I'm sorry, I'm referring to it as a Gaffney-Klein model.
Yeah, well, we got the Commissioner of Revenue and Gaffney-Klein sitting right next to him, so it was close.
Well, okay, I apologize if I've misrepresented that.
Well, that's fine. Let's just have a brief at ease. I just want to does your schedule. Another 15 minutes, and then we're going to stop for the day, and we'll pick back up at 9 o'clock. Okay.
So I'm not going to dwell on these diagrams, but again, this model was done, in fact, the slides like this are my model. They were done more than a year ago, and they were presented to a joint finance and resource committee, I think March 2009. And the point being that I think this issue of cross subsidy has been made not just by myself and Dan Dickinson, but others as well. And it is an issue I think that needs to be considered quite seriously. Sorry, let me just go back there. In fact, the position becomes even more significant if we factor in reinvestment. If some of the profits are reinvested, then the effect of that cross subsidy by further reducing the production tax values can further, accentuate this particular problem. And again, without going into the details here, I just make the point that these inflection points are an artifact of the structure of the progressivity in its different phases. But it does make progressivity quite difficult to predict. It makes it a counterintuitive type behavior, because nobody knows. I don't care whose forecast it is. We don't know what the price parity is going to be. We don't know what the oil price. We don't know what the gas price is going to be. Even more complex is that over a multi-year period, the oil to gas ratio of the whole of the North Slope is going to change as gas progressively replaces oil. And for each company, each of the companies is going to have a different oil to gas ratio per field and in its portfolio. So trying to work out what is the actual nature and impact of this combined oil and gas progressivity becomes a very complex issue. By simply separating that out, you would remove a lot of those complications. So I'm going to skip those few slides. And I think this slide is saying, again, what I've just said. It's very difficult to predict whether you're a tax authority or whether you're a producer. Yes, producers may well like the idea of a cross-subsidy, but a cross-subsidy that's at the high end of the scale in very profitable conditions may be attractive, but I'm not sure that it from a producer perspective, but its effects, again, are very difficult even for them to produce, to predict, and that means it is difficult to plan with. And we don't know what each company is going to the position it's going to be in terms of reinvestment, etc. So it is very difficult to take a view on what is the impact of this over the longer period. And the counterintuitive bit is that we, as has been demonstrated, we can have a high price situation that could ultimately lead to a lower tax revenue for the state in some scenarios, which I believe is not only unacceptable, but it's unstable, because there is no government that is going to accept going in, even if it's into a price spike, where, and by a price spike I mean a high oil price for a period of months relative to a low gas price, where their revenue is actually going to go down as a consequence of that. That kind of fiscal system is not going to be enduring. And the major oil companies know that as well around the world, that when they get into that situation where their fiscal design is out of sync with the market, that what happens is that the fiscal regimes get adjusted. So I don't think this kind of structure is stable in the longer term. Now, this flow diagram looks at the Alaska fiscal design, and it looks at what potentially could be done to address this issue of combined progressivity. And the simplest step really is to just to delink the oil and gas components, and then that leads to, well, how do you then calculate or impose progressivity on the gas stream? In the study that I presented to the LBNA back in December of 2008, I came up with some alternative mechanisms that could be used. I put those up there and refer back to that report. But I make the point that just really to remove this complexity and problem, just by separating out in what I call here a gas production tax and an oil production tax, and they could both be could be based on a production tax value, that would be the first easiest step that would simplify the problem and remove this issue of cross subsidy. And if it was deemed that incentives were needed to attract producing companies to invest in a gas line or other projects, then those inducements should be directed at the regressive end of the spectrum, not into this progressivity area.
I think if we could stop there,
yeah.
Maybe Dr. Wood, if we have any questions, I think it looks like a good spot to stop for the day because
yes.
It's kind of a break.
Yeah.
Do we have any questions? Senator Egan.
Just one question, Mr. Chair.
Could you pull your mic in, please?
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. So what do you think the deadline is? Is it before 2014? If we decide to make some kind of a tweak, or is it before May 1?
Through the chair, my belief is that, and you know what is possible and not possible in Alaska far more than I do, but my belief is that before May 1 would simplify the situation, because the longer you leave that, the more difficult it is going to be to unravel, and there are going to be all sorts of other issues that become involved. So the quicker it's done, the easier it will be in the long term. Whether it's possible to do that, that's not for me to say.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Wood. We'll see you again at 9 a.m. And we'll see everybody here at 9 a.m. Meeting adjourned.